This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn. I'm Lee Chui Lin. Behind the glamour and glory of competing at the Olympics lies an inadequate financial infrastructure to support athletes. A majority of the 11,000 Olympians will count themselves lucky just to not be financially broke when the games end. One interesting development on track and field is that athletes without sponsors or who are prohibited by their sponsors from wearing a competing brand will be covering up their shoes logo. Sports lawyers Richard Wee and Leslie Lim are here to talk about athlete sponsors and to a certain extent, ambush marketing. So this idea of having to cover up your shoes logo, where does that come in?
Well, the contracts that and the deals and the sponsorship agreements which the Olympic Council, the IOC, have with their main sponsors, usually those deals would include terms which would state that the sponsor's logo would be the sole prominent logo. So without mentioning any particular sports brand, so if sports brand X have signed a contract with IOC, they would not like to see brand A on the badge. So I believe what's happening in the track and field is that there is some deal which has been agreed to have a exclusive sponsorship of brand X, and brand A, B and C are not permitted. So we are seeing that happening now in Rio.
Why do you think corporations have always been drawn towards track and field? What aspects of it makes it, commercially compelling?
Well, I must say that the track and field is one of the highest television rates, television returns for the Olympics. So even the ASEAN Games and the SEA Games, one of the most exciting things to watch during this tournament is actually the track and field. So with so much media attention to it, it immediately draws into sponsors. And also the sexiness of the event, the 100-meter race and 200-meter race, both for men and women, is actually the epitome of speed, power and strength. And athletes like Usain Bolt, Carl Lewis, they are legends in their name because of what they have done. So sponsors will want to be connected to that legendary status, So hence the connection between sponsors and track and field.
So we've been using the word sponsor, but you also hear words like endorsement. Is there a difference between an endorsement deal and a sponsorship?
Well, I'm going to pass it to Leslie for this. Yeah.
So just generally, sponsorship is basically where sponsors or a company gives money. And they expect something in return. So the very common thing that you see is a brand sponsors an event, and in return, the event at the venue, you will see their banners. So that's an example of sponsorship. Endorsement is more towards where a athlete shows their support for a particular brand or a product, and in return, they, of course, get compensation. So one example would be Jordan, Michael Jordan and Nike, which is of course developed into this multi-million dollar brand that Jordan has with Nike today. So in return, the sponsor basically gets the right to use the athletes, their name, their image, their likeness, in connection with the sponsor's brand or services. So yeah, that's generally the difference between sponsorship and endorsements.
A lot of athletes don't draw annual salaries as such, and they struggle financially without sponsorships. The IOC, or the International Olympics Committee, doesn't pay appearance fee or prize money at the Games. Should this position be reversed?
Well, the IOC, or even for the matter FIFA or any international organisation, they will not pay for the appearance fee. And it makes sense, simply because you're invited to take part in the tournament. Since you've agreed to come for a tournament, then welcome aboard. That's the first thing. So therefore, the athlete's financial well-being should be taken care of by the national association of that country. So like Malaysia, for example, I'm aware that our athletes are financially taken care of. I'm not sure of the quantum, that I can't comment. But most athletes, or in fact all the athletes who take part in the Olympics, are financially maintained. They're taken care of. So that will help the athletes to have a peace of mind. At the end of the day, actually, I think the main thing here, Lynn, is this. While the athletes want to enrich themselves, or we want to see the athletes enrich themselves either way, the key thing is that the athletes must be mentally and spiritually calm during the sports. And he or she will not be happy if he's not sure whether there's money tomorrow to pay his house, you know, or her family, you know. So that's the main reason how this concept came about, to compensate the athlete. But of course, it's, the last 40 years has evolved into this huge multi-billion dollar sponsorship deals. So to answer your question, I don't think it needed to be reversed, simply because these tournaments are on invited basis. We don't realize actually you're invited to take part. It's not my God-given right that I must take part, you know. What IOC does is that they actually compensate the national associations. There's always some financial dealings between the IOC and the country's local IOC, in Malaysia's OCM, where there's some kind of agreement, bursary, or, you know, it happens. But I think the better person to answer that would be someone from OCM.
Right. Yeah. Although we've been talking primarily about athletes and athletes and marketing, but there's also something in sports called ambush marketing. What is that?
Well, Lynn, it's happened many times. I recall, I'm speaking off the cuff, so I could be inaccurate. Sometime in 2010, the World Cup in South Africa, Football World Cup, there was an event, occasion where in one of the matches, a group of people were in the stadium wearing very bright shirts. It could be either orange or pink. And what they were doing is they were promoting a product of a company. And of course, the FIFA was not happy. FIFA removed the group. That's a classic example of ambush marketing. Or in the case of track and field, which is a topic today, if a watch brand signs a sponsor with a prominent athlete, say Usain Bolt, and you see Usain Bolt suddenly wearing this watch while he's running, that is another way of ambush marketing. At the very last minute, you made him wear the watch, for example. But the classic ambush marketing is actually engaging a certain amount of, for example, spectator to appear at a particular place in the arena and make themselves seen, visible. And with the advent of social media, the extent and the reach of social media, ambush marketing can sometimes be more effective than the main sponsorship between the track and field and the sponsors, for example. So that's an example of ambush marketing, literally ambushing the event and making yourself seen.
Considering how tricky it is to deal with, I mean, what are you going to do about spectators? How are you going to control? Are you going to make everybody take off their shirts before they enter an arena?
That's the thing.
How do you protect the event against ambush marketing?
At the moment, from what we have seen, there's very little way of controlling it. I think organizations like FIFA and the Olympic councils. How do you actually stop someone? They say, hey, can I check your bag first? Can I check what you're wearing inside? You know, when I sell a ticket to you, please answer these 10 questions, you know. So I think from our case studies that we have seen in the States and in Europe, it's pretty difficult to control. So one way is, I'll give you an example. One way is this. Another classic ambush marketing I want to address is television, where a sponsor conveniently buy a advertising spot just before that particular event. So, you know, at 10 a.m., there will be a track and field event. So, the sponsor buys at 9:59. And it will appear there. So, people will actually watch that spot. So, what people do now is, let's say if the track and field is sponsored by Brand X, Brand X now will buy even the advertisement spot on TV and radio half an hour before and half an hour later. So that's one. In the stadium, now you can see it's very common. Brand X will probably give out free shirts so that everyone wear their shirt. Or you've seen in badminton, Brand A will give this flapping thing, which looks like a hand clapping thing. It's actually a way to fight off ambush marketing, to overwhelm the ambush marketing, because there's a lot more of my product than your product in the stadium. So that's how they go around. So people get excited. Oh, I get free stuff. But actually what's happening is that the marketing people are trying to stop ambush marketing. So instead of trying to totally stop that kind of ambush marketing, what most sponsors have done is they try to overwhelm it and you know, beat them at their own game, as so per se.
Yeah, I mean, in the US, I think they've taken a little bit more serious steps. I think recently for the Rio 2016, there was a particular athletic apparel company. I'm trying to recall the name. I think it's Oixil or something along those lines. So it became to an extent where the US Olympic Committee actually sent them a letter of demand, demanding that they remove certain content on social media, failing which the US Olympic Committee would actually take legal action against the brand. So I think, it depends on the seriousness of the situation. And clearly that was a very serious case, you know, to take legal steps in that direction.
I'm speaking today with lawyers Richard Wee and Leslie Lim, and we're talking about the Olympics and sponsorship as well as marketing, and really ambush marketing to a large degree. Up next, we talk a little bit about Rule 40 in the IOC. You are listening today to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin. In the studio with me today, sports lawyers Richard Wee and Leslie Lim. And we're talking about the Olympics and sponsorship and marketing. Now, the IOC, or the International Olympics Committee, has a rule called Rule 40, which prevents athletes from advertising for non-Olympic sponsors just before and during the Games. What is Rule 40 exactly? Is it fair?
Before I jump into Rule 40, I just give a little bit of background. So there's Rule 7 of the Olympic Charter, which basically grants the International Olympic Committee, which we call IOC, exclusive ownership over certain Olympic brands, so to speak. So that includes the Olympic rings, the Olympic flag, the torch, the flame, emblems, along those lines. Just to give you an idea of the magnitude of this protection that the IOC has, the IOC actually requires host countries, countries that are going to host the Olympics, to enact specific intellectual property legislation granting trademark protection to the IOC. So that's the kind of magnitude that we're looking at. So Rule 40, as you mentioned, Lynn, is basically whereby non-sponsors of the Olympic Games and athletes are not allowed to mention about their relationship during a blackout period. So this blackout period happens 9 days before the start of the opening ceremony, up until 3 days after the closing ceremony. So people like us, individuals, news media like BFM, and official sponsors, McDonald's, Procter & Gamble, Visa, Coca-Cola, we can talk about the games freely, but if you don't fall in those categories, basically, you cannot speak about the Olympics. So it involves a whole range of things. Olympic has trademark words and phrases. This includes words like Olympic, Olympian, Team USA, go for the goal, let the games begin, Paralympics. So it's this whole range of words, and these are all trademarked. You cannot even use words that incorporate the word Olympic. Mathlympics, Aqualympics, Chicago Olympics, Radio Olympics. It even reaches to an extent where you're actually not even allowed to wish the athletes good luck if you're a business that's not one of the official sponsors. So I know it seems all doom and gloom, but on the bright side, what's happened of late is that in February 2015, the IOC announced some changes in their rules. And this change allows is it allows athletes to actually appear in generic advertising which do not explicitly mention about the games or use any of the Olympic intellectual property.
I can't stand there with my gold medal, for instance. Can I do that?
Yeah, you can stand with your gold medal, but you cannot show off the brand that you actually have a personal sponsorship with during the period of the games. So I'll give you an example of one brand who did this brilliantly. It's actually Under Armour. I don't know if you've seen the ad. Under Armour had this ad which they did for Michael Phelps. So it basically portrayed the most decorated Olympian in history preparing for his last outing at the games. Very brilliantly done. There was no mention at all about the Olympics and whatnot. But when you're watching it, you clearly, there's this implied line and you know that he's preparing for the games. And he even ends with this phrase, it's what you do in the dark that matters and that's what puts you in the light. So it was really, really brilliantly done by Under Armour. Under Armour was, of course, one of the very happy parties of this rule change because to them, it fulfilled their objective of being able to support their athletes or Olympic hopefuls who are tied to the Under Armour brand. And Under Armour actually sponsors something like 250 Olympic athletes, even though Under Armour is not an official sponsor of the Games. But that's the happy side of it. So, but there are, of course, businesses who still think that even with the rule change, things are still very restrictive because, of course, this rule change comes along with certain requirements, one of which is a waiver has to be submitted in January 2016. So some businesses say, oh, you know, January 2016 is a little bit early because some athletes don't even know at that time whether or not they have actually qualified for the Olympics. The other thing is that the ad must actually start running from March 2016. And for smaller businesses, this can be very expensive because it basically means for them to hinge on, you know, the Olympic Games and to benefit from it commercially, they actually need to run their ad from March to August. And that's very expensive for small businesses. The other downside that some parties have raised is that if I'm an Olympic sponsor, I feel that this rule change has actually devalued my sponsorship, the rights that I've paid millions of dollars from. And just, I think Coca-Cola paid London 2012 about $100 million to be an official sponsor. So now that the gates are opening up just slightly for all this, you know, non-sponsors to come in and do these generic advertisements, there is a question of how the official sponsors are going to feel and whether this partnership between the official sponsors and the games are going to be affected moving forward, say for Tokyo 2020, looking ahead in 4 years' time. So yeah, that's a general idea of what Rule 40 is about.
And the reason why Rule 40 would exist is the argument here is it allows the committee to have exclusive partnerships, and then that, of course, allows the games to be financed and an incentive for athletes in need around the world. Is this a fair trade-off? I mean, I'm sure Under Armour would have something different to say compared to, say, Coca-Cola, but is it a fair trade-off?
Hard to say. I think commercially we need to see how Rule 40 evolves.
Correct.
I think this is the first one, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
I remember we discussed about this. So this is the first time, the first Olympics, we are seeing the new Rule 40 involved. Maybe after Rio, we'll know better. Thus far, from our readings, we have not heard of any murmurings and complaints from the main sponsors. Maybe not yet. But to be fair, looking at the logos and the partnership with the main sponsors, they're still all over the place. You can see them all over, very visible names.
And the Olympics is a huge pie. I mean,
correct.
That would be my argument. Yeah. It's a gigantic pie.
Yeah. If I were a brand, I would definitely want to be associated with the Olympic Games. It is the largest sporting event in the world in terms of the size, the scale, the range of events. The audience, the
worldwide broadcasting,
correct, the money being generated from it. And I think the only other event that's comparable is probably the FIFA World Cup.
Yep.
Yeah, it's not even the Commonwealth Games. Yeah. No. So other than shoes and jerseys, where else can sponsors put their brand? Where else are we likely to see, you know, those logos, those taglines during the games?
Well, the few which we can think of seems to be still perhaps uncontrolled will be like the watch, for example, or wearing a pair of Oakley specs, Oakley glasses, shades, Oakley shades. These are still very much in the athlete's control. I mean, when the athletes run, the athletes will say, I need shades because it's so bright. I foresee one day if someone is really creative, they'll create some kind of temporary tattoo, you know, stick on the athlete's face or something like that. You never know. But I will say this, Lynn, actually, while this so-called rules are, and that's the reason why I use the word so-called. So-called rules seems to disallow athletes to prominently put up their sponsors, but unfortunately, it also depends on the bargaining power, which is something hard. It's hard for us to talk because different athletes got different bargaining power. So, but one classic example is Mr. Usain Bolt. He's clearly sponsored by Puma. He's made it very clear about that. But whether or not he's allowed to wear Puma during the games, I think probably yes, because he's Bolt.
Usain Bolt.
Yeah, Usain Bolt, yeah. So while we try to see, oh, you know, the rules will say, oh, you can't do this, you can't do that. But we've seen some athletes get away with it, you know, and I think it's purely because of the charisma and the status of the athlete. So there you go.
Yeah, and I think marketing agencies have really, really stepped up their game in terms of being very creative on how brands are put forth. They've gone to the extent where they've created animated videos. They create their own hashtags. They write on colors to promote certain brands. They get the color to be very, very closely associated to the brand and whatnot. So that's a very commercial answer, not very much a legal answer.
Considering that there's only really the Olympics and then there's the World Cup, are there enough sporting events to A, make the current sponsorship model sustainable, and B, provide enough, I guess, precedent to work these issues out? Because if there are only a few events that are this big that will have these quote-unquote rules applying to them, and then do we actually have enough material from which to come up with a framework, a legal framework?
Lynn, can I ask you first, are you referring to track and field or generally any?
Generally anything.
Well, off the cuff, we have the Winter Olympics and then the regional games, American Games and the
ASEAN
Games.
Mm-hmm. There's also the World Championships.
World Championship for the athletes, World Championship for badminton, then the annual year-end tennis, so-called
ATP finals.
I won't call it Grand Slam. The Grand Slam of Grand Slam. Yeah. ATP finals. That's how they can sustain. And then even in athletic, there are races where it's called the $1 million race or the gold bar race, where every time an athlete run and you hit a record or you finish top three, you get X amount of ringgit, and that race is broadcasted all over the world. That's other ways to do it. Of course, as we said earlier, nothing is bigger than Olympics. That's no doubt about that. But there are other fairly large tournaments to sustain the sponsorship.
And then working out the rules for the Olympics, will it always be a little bit slow because it takes 4 years to kind of see where things are? You have to wait after that to see whether sponsors complain. You have to kind of weigh things out. And it is really every 4 years. So will it take a while for there to be sort of a negotiation, and an arrival at a new framework or at a sustainable framework?
Well, to be fair to the IOC, they have evolved from the days when the 1980 Olympics in Moscow and 84 Olympics in Los Angeles. Those the beginning of the commercialization of sports at the time, or that kind of sports at the time. They have evolved slowly. But you're right. I think for testing period, they can only test it once every 4 years. But having said that, they are filled with very experienced people. They have other satellite tournaments going on at the same time, like the qualifying tournaments, and they have the time race tournament. So the IOC is always around.
It's
so
not
they
the same
see.
Though.
You're right.
Of course.
In terms of the sheer volume and size. But once every 4 years, they get some things correct, some things not so correct. And then the next tournament they do it. I must say, the last Olympics in London was really good. Really, really well organized. Kudos to the organizers and IOC. I recall one really not so good tournament is Atlanta in 96. Yeah. That was really full of problems despite CNN and Coca-Cola based there, but they had so much issues. And I'm concerned of Rio because they're already murmuring.
Yes. Yeah. Everybody is concerned with Rio.
Yeah, the pool is turning green, the bus is coming late.
The apartments are inhabitable.
Yeah, so it's a worry, yeah.
Earlier this year, coming back home, it wasn't clear whether Lee Chong Wei would be in the podium program because of his personal sponsorships. Firstly, what is the podium program? And secondly, what are the possible reasons that this would have happened, speaking generally?
So the podium program is a program under the National Sports Institute under YB Kyrie. So it was an initiative by the Ministry of Youth and Sports to produce podium winners consistently and continuously for major championships. So there was this issue because Chong Wei was hesitating to sign a contract for the podium program. And from what we understand, there was possibly a conflict of interest between his personal sponsorships. He, of course, owes certain obligations and responsibilities to his own sponsors. And of course, the podium program also has their own batch of sponsors. And I think it got a little bit complicated because the podium program doesn't only involve Chong Wei. It involved a whole range of other badminton players who then in turn had their personal sponsors to deal with. So I think the whole issue at the back of it was perhaps an issue of conflict of interest. And I suppose one way to go about it is that parties would actually have to sit down and negotiate. the terms of the contract to see if there are any exceptions where maybe Chong Wei for a certain period could do certain things for the sponsors of the podium program, but for the rest of his time, he would of course be obliged to his own sponsors and whatnot. But I can't comment specifically on Chong Wei's situation, but I do understand that eventually he did sign for the podium program.
Besides corporate sponsorships and government support, are there any other avenues for athletes to make money without having to take a day job? Because, you know, we've been talking about sponsorship and marketing, and the reason why is because sports is lucrative, but sometimes athletes can suffer in the midst of it.
There are a few ways for athletes who can go beyond sponsorship and government support. One is, for example, appearing as a pundit, you know, or coming to BFM to speak, you know, and get paid for it. But appearing on television as pundits is one of it. Appearance fee, I think some of us may not realize, but some tournaments in Malaysia, the athlete is actually engaged to come and take part. Whether he or she wins is irrespective. Not an issue, but please come. So some athletes are paid. Just to appear. So you actually make money that way. For those athletes who are not fairly known, not very up in the top rank yet, the athletes will probably be able to do coaching, training. They can become very good motivating speakers. There's some money to be made there. Of course, not a lot, but there are opportunities there. There's also endorsements.
I was just thinking, you know, out of curiosity, you have someone like Lee Chong Wei, who is marketable because of his status within the sport. You know, world number one, our Malaysian number one for who knows how long now. And that's Lee Chong Wei. On the other hand, you have someone like David Beckham, who was never the best at his sport, but who was a deeply marketable player. So when we're talking about money-making opportunities and things like sponsorships, things like marketing, at this point in time, and this is just, it's not really a legal question, but in your view, is it better to be a Lee Chong Wei or to be a David Beckham in terms of making money outside your sport?
Of course, David Beckham. Nothing against Chong Wei. I think Chong Wei's lawyer who hear this interview
well,
will be
okay,
upset with me.
But let's not do David Beckham then. Someone like Lionel Messi, who is, you know, some might say the best football player of his generation, but who is not as marketable on a very basic level as David Beckham. So let's you know, take Chong Wei out of the equation then. So Lionel Messi and David Beckham, is it better at this point in time to be the most talented or is it better to be the most marketable?
I think for an athlete, is you want to be the best, of course. But for the sponsor's point of view, you always want to find a man or the woman who is most marketable for your product. So for an athlete, eventually when he or she is eyeing retirement, then they want to make sure that they are marketable.
Everyone wants to be David Beckham at the end.
Beckham is, I think he will be the only one. I don't think anybody else can copy what he's doing. And he's got a brilliant partner and his wife. Victoria has made sure that he's marketable, you know, and despite he's got a fairly funny, squeaky voice, but he's been able to camouflage that with his good looks. So there you go.
And the reason why people seek avenues outside of sport is, of course, because it's a short career. Mm. And on top of that, injuries and poor performances can undermine that already very brief career. So how else can they capitalize on their talents?
Well, on this point, it's not really about capitalizing, but I can share that I think athletes must really seriously look at sports insurance. We have a fair bit of Malaysian insurance companies developing this area, and I think one or two have developed it and have products about it. We are keeping a close eye on those products, really good products. And athletes really should allocate a certain amount of their income to buy this sports insurance, which usually is about injury. So a classic one is in UK, Dean Ashton, a really talented young footballer, grew up through Crewe and then went to Norwich and then eventually ended up in West Ham. And in one of the training matches playing for England, unfortunately someone broke his leg. He recovered, but he never fully recovered and eventually was forced to retire because of that. And I think he was like less than 25 years old. But because he had a decent amount of insurance, sports insurance, he didn't become wealthy, but he was covered for a certain amount of time.
Are you insuring yourself for your potential or for your existing I guess, proof of concept as such. You know, do you have to prove your talent, or are you saying, well, potentially I could earn this much?
No, there are many kinds of insurance. The first insurance we are talking about is purely about injuries, which any athlete can take up. Of course, the more risky your sports is, the bigger you are, the more big games you play, then your premium will go up. I can imagine Ronaldo's and Messi's insurance will be far higher than a Malaysian second division player.
You know? So for a career-ending injury, for example, Cristiano Ronaldo, we are assuming, would likely be covered.
Well, he'll probably get a certain amount of money, but I'm not sure how much. Of course, none of us have access to his contracts, but definitely he will earn some or gain some compensation. You know, but I think knowing people like them, they rather continue playing. But people like Ronaldo, no problem. Even when he retires tomorrow, his sponsorship around him, he will sustain.
A club in China will buy him. Yeah. He will be fine.
That's true.
Athletes also have to balance between pleasing their sponsors and wearing the right gear for their performance. What advice would you offer an athlete who is maybe not super happy about their sponsor's gear, but they can't afford to turn down a sponsorship?
Oh, well, I would say first thing first, sit down and talk to the sponsor. I think explain to them the situation, because the very fact that they are sponsoring you, I think from the start, they believed in the athlete to a certain extent. And of course, they want you to be successful, because the success of the athlete is only going to help the brand and the company that's sponsoring. So I think first things first, sit down and speak. So say if I'm a track and field athlete, and I find that, you know, my running shoes is not sitting very well, it's eating into my toes, or I get huge blisters at the back. And I think you just speak to the sponsor and see if there's a way you can rectify it. Of course, I concede if you're not like Rafael Nadal or Roger Federer, where Babalot and Wilson tailors a specific record according to exactly what they need for their game. But I do think by speaking to the sponsors, I'm sure something can be worked out.
Yeah, I think so too.
I've been speaking today with sports lawyers Richard Wee and Leslie Lim. We've been talking about Olympics and sponsorship and ambush marketing and just all manner of things to do with sports and money today. You have been listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.